Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University in Australia, and I'm also currently a Danish Diabetes and Endocrine Academy visiting professor at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. The idea behind Inside Exercise is to bring to you the absolute who's who of exercise research, so exercise physiology, exercise metabolism, and exercise and health. And what I'm actually wanting is for you to get your information about exercise from the exercise researchers, experts in the field, rather than from influencers. And indeed, today I bring to you Professor Erik Richter from the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. He's my great collaborator who I've been working with now during four research visits. He is the absolute godfather, the expert on glucose metabolism during exercise. So for over 40 years, he's been looking at regulation of glucose uptake with contraction, the effect of exercise on insulin sensitivity. So he was the first person to show that contraction can increase glucose uptake into muscle independent of insulin. But at the same time, he showed that exercise can increase insulin sensitivity. We also talked about how exercise may affect appetite. So there's evidence that especially high-intensity exercise can reduce your appetite for a period of time. So we talked about what might be regulating that. You'll find that he's an absolute wealth of knowledge and just really easy to listen to, easy to take on board what he's talking about. I think you'll find it really interesting. So stick around. Hello, Erik. Welcome to Inside Exercise. Thanks for coming on. How are you?
Thanks. Oh, I'm fine. Thank you very much, Glenn. Looking forward.
It's a funny situation because for those that don't know, I'm visiting professor in Erik's lab. And this is like the fourth visit. So we're just like chatting out like 2 minutes ago and then we come in and put on the Zoom stuff. So it's great being here. So yeah, I had 5 weeks in 2013, 6 months, 2016, 19, and again now. So it's great hanging out and doing the research sort of stuff we'll be talking about. So interactions between exercise and insulin, which we'll be talking about at length. But what I like doing is getting a bit of a background. So if we think right back to when how did you first get into this? Were you like a sports sort of exercise type person, or I know you were a medical doctor, did you get into medicine then think you might want to do exercise? How did you actually get into all this?
Well, it started in medical school when I had physiology class, and I was quite interested in cardiovascular physiology at first. That's been an interest that I've maintained actually all my life, but I went to the lecturer and asked if he had time to use a medical student in his research lab. And he said, well, not really, but I know somebody who might be interested. And he referred me to Henrik Galbo, who was a young upcoming star at the time and doing exercise endocrinology. And that was actually quite interesting also. And it was a fairly new field at the time, back in the late 70s, actually. So I did some studies with him. And the first couple of studies we did were actually with Jens Holst, who you might know because he is the discoverer of GLP-1. And of course, this has had a major impact on clinical treatment of diabetes and now obesity. And he was interested in glucagon at the time. And we were then thinking about whether glucagon secretion during exercise actually has a role in regulating hepatic glucose production. So we treated mice, we anesthetized mice with ether at the time. And then I made a cardiac puncture into the rat heart and then injected glucagon anti-serum or control serum, and then we let the rat wake up very quickly because ether doesn't last that long. And then we exercised them and then looked again at the liver glycogen concentration. Actually, it showed that glucagon, when you neutralize glucagon, the decrease in hepatic glucose hepatic glycogen concentration was actually less. So glucagon has an effect, at least in the rat, on glycogen breakdown in the liver. So that was and the funny thing is that the publication that came out of this research in glucagon, there were other we did some other studies as well, looking at glucose control and so on. But it came out in JCI, and it was my first publication, and I ended up as last author, which was kind of interesting, at least in these days, because, I mean, last author is usually the head of the lab. But so my first publication was the last author one in JCI.
Wow. Yeah. So Journal of Clinical Investigation. Journal.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it is. So the main focus of my work with Henrik was actually on the sympathoadrenal system in regulation of glycogen breakdown in muscle, not so much in liver. Mm-hmm. And we did some studies in rats. I developed a technique to destroy the adrenal medulla in a rat without destroying the cortex, so that they were unable to secrete epinephrine. And sure enough, in the rat, when you exercise the rat, if it doesn't have epinephrine, it breaks down less glycogen in the muscle during exercise. So we then had the idea to look at isolated muscle. And isolated muscle was, we thought of a model that was developed by Neil Ruderman in Boston, the isolated perfused rat hind limb preparation, where you put in catheters in the aorta and in the vena cava inferior, and then you can perfuse the hind limbs of a rat, and you can of course control what's in the perfusate, and you can then measure glucose uptake or whatever you want to do across the hind limbs. So I went to Boston and was a researcher. It was after my medical degree, and did a fellowship with Neil Ruderman and did some work on epinephrine also in isolated muscle, and that was all very fine. And but Neil is an endocrinologist, and he works clinically as well, and he also had a diabetes clinic at the Boston University Medical Center. And we all knew, of course, that if you're an insulin-treated diabetic patient, then you are sometimes prone to hypoglycemia, not only during exercise, but also following exercise, several hours after exercise. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was not really known what the mechanism was behind this. So Neil and I talked about it, and then we discussed, well, whether it could be the muscles that actually increase their insulin sensitivity following exercise. And that is that we then went on to test in a rat study, where rats were either exercised or non-exercised. And then we perfused the muscles with different insulin concentrations. And sure enough, I guess that was the first time that we really showed that insulin sensitivity of skeletal muscle was enhanced following exercise, at least in the rat. And that was also published in JCI, and was, I guess, the first study that really set me on to look at insulin sensitivity, insulin action in muscle in combination with exercise. So that was what set me off for the study in Neil's lab.
A lot of classic studies there. I wonder if we can try and, because I know myself trying to write grants and things, explaining to the person writing the grant, reading the grant, and then the people listening now, how glucose regulation, insulin regulation, how talking about what regulates glucose uptake during exercise, for example, and then saying how it's different to insulin, but then saying but at the same time, exercise increases insulin sensitivity. It becomes sort of hard to explain. Do you want to just take people through that a little bit about regulation of glucose uptake during exercise, and then what insulin does at rest, and then and then how after exercise, et cetera?
Long story.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah. So, I mean, when muscle contracts, you elicit some molecular signaling that leads to translocation of the GLUT4 glucose transporters from the inside of the muscle to the muscle membrane, the surface membrane, and the T tubules in the muscle. And that is a mechanism that is independent of insulin. And we actually also showed that, because at the time when I was in Neil's lab, it was thought that there had to be a so-called permissive effect, permissive concentration of insulin in the blood for contractions to actually work. And we thought that was a pretty... I didn't think it was really going to be that way. So we actually showed that if you completely remove insulin from the circulation in either in vivo or in the perfused system, where you can do it very easily, then muscle contractions that were stimulated electrically would still increase glucose uptake quite a lot. So there are mechanisms that are, and we can talk about what they might be, but there are mechanisms that in the muscle, when they contract, sets off this translocation of GLUT4 to the surface membrane and the T-tubules. And of course, there's also in vivo a large increase in blood flow. So that provides a lot of delivery of glucose to the muscle, and therefore you get a quite robust increase in glucose uptake. And it can actually increase up to 100-fold more than you see at rest if the conditions are at maximal exercise and in vivo and so on. So it's a really powerful mechanism, and it's interesting because it is independent of insulin. It also works in patients with diabetes and also both type 1 and type 2 diabetic patients. So exercise works very well in patients that are insulin deficient.
Exactly. So I was just going to say that's the important thing. Like often people, if you talk to, I don't know, your average medical doctor, they might think exercise is good for people with type 2 diabetes because it causes weight loss, et cetera, but not necessarily realizing that every bout of exercise increases glucose uptake during the exercise. And also, as I'm sure you were about to say, increases insulin sensitivity after exercise. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the contraction-induced glucose uptake doesn't last that long. It depends on the intensity and the duration of the exercise, but it's usually gone within a few hours, 2 to 3 to 4 hours. But then there's another effect, and that is that insulin then works much better in a muscle that has exercised compared to one that hasn't exercised, and that's probably the basis for the clinical problems that we know type 1 diabetic patients have many hours after exercise if they are not conscious about the problems with increased insulin sensitivity after exercise. And that can last at least 24, and the longest we've seen published is 48 hours following a single bout of exercise. You can have increased insulin sensitivity. That was published by Corey Mikines in Henrik Galbo's lab many years ago.
So just to clarify that people are aware of what you're saying there. So yeah, if you're a person with type 1 diabetes and you're measuring your glucose with finger pricks or continuous glucose monitoring or whatever, and then you exercise, your muscle will be more sensitive to insulin for the next 24 to 48 hours. And they've got to be careful not to get a hypo, so a reduction in their glucose. And apparently that's part of the reason why. So I've had Michael Riddell on, and he was saying that's part of the reason why it's hard. You know, it's hard enough to get people to exercise anyway, but people with type 1 are worried about getting this hypo. And I wonder if we can just touch on the fact that during exercise, you're releasing glucose from the liver. You know, obviously, assuming you're fasted, if you've been eating, you'll get glucose from the liver and also some from the gut, and then your muscles taking it up, and the glucose may not actually change, right? But it doesn't mean nothing's happening. As you said, you can get up to 100-fold increase. But even if you do high intensity exercise, so thinking again with the type 1 diabetics, why don't you just say what can happen with high intensity exercise to glucose concentrations as well?
Yeah, so normally if you do moderate exercise, the plasma glucose concentration stays pretty much at the fasting level. But if you do a very high intensity exercise, it actually increases quite a lot. And also both in people without diabetes, but also in people that have type 1 diabetes. And and particularly in well-trained athletes, if they really hit, if they really do high intensity exercise, you can see glucose concentrations reaching 10 millimolar or so in the blood during exercise, and it and it stays up for a while. So there's, in that situation, there's a, you could say maybe a mismatch between the hepatic glucose production and the utilization in the muscles. At least it looks like the signaling to the liver is more than is actually needed to maintain euglycemia. And why is that? I don't know.
Do you think it might be so the muscle gets a go at it, you know, while it's elevated to increase its glucose uptake? Or I guess you're saying the first few hours it's not really insulin. So I guess then it's, you got to be careful. So again, with Michael Riddell was saying how it's confusing for someone with type 1 diabetes because their glucose is elevated and they might think, oh, I've got to take a shot of insulin, but their muscle will be more sensitive to insulin. So that's really situation. They've got to be careful not to have a hypo. Okay, so you were talking about how the exercise increases insulin sensitivity for 24 to 48 hours. Can I ask, I don't think it's been looked at that much, but is it the same pretty much? So you know how you said people with type 2 diabetes have normal glucose uptake during exercise. Do they also get a normal increase in insulin sensitivity after exercise or after an acute bout?
Yeah, it hasn't been researched that much, but the studies that are out there suggest that type 2 diabetics also get a good increase in insulin sensitivity following exercise. So,
which is great. Okay, so I don't know. Did you want to talk about, because it's always interesting, you know, what we've been doing together, et cetera, is looking at regulation of these things. Did you want to talk about regulation of glucose uptake during exercise, regulation after exercise, other, I don't know.
Yeah, sure.
So the stuff,
So during exercise, there in the muscle, there is a lot of molecular signaling going on during exercise, and that is, you know, the most prevalent signaling is probably phosphorylation and dephosphorylation of various enzymes and proteins in the muscle. And some years ago, we published together with David James in Australia that the phosphoproteome of muscle right after in exercise compared to before exercise, where we actually discovered that more than 1,000 proteins in the muscle had changed their phosphorylation status just during 10 minutes of fairly high intensity exercise. And that was a staggering number because we knew, of course, some of the signaling that was going on, AMP kinase, for instance, and chem kinase and stuff. But getting this whole list of 1,000 proteins that changed the phosphorylation status just by 10 minutes of exercise was really, really an eye-opener. Mm-hmm. And it led to discovery of several new players in the field, so a lot of several new AMP kinase targets and other targets that seem to play a role in exercise metabolism and also in muscle development and so on. So what actually regulates glucose uptake during exercise is not so easy, as you know, to know, because the way I view it these days is that there are many mechanisms that are activated that potentially lead to increased glucose uptake, so that means GLUT4 translocation. And some of them are probably redundant. So if you take out one mechanism, then some of the other ones will just compensate. So I think that's the way we look at it. And I guess one of the more recent discoveries that we've done in this department with Carlos and Thomas Jensen was that the reactive oxygen species are important for activating glucose uptake, and that is also via, and that also involves RAG1 that we've been working with for quite a while with Lucas Sulo and also Thomas. So RAG1 is a component of of the enzyme NOX2 that makes the reactive oxygen species. And these somehow, and I don't think we know the mechanism exactly, but somehow leads to GLUT4 translocation in muscle during exercise and is part of the signaling that leads to increased glucose uptake during exercise. AMP kinase has also been involved for many years, and it's been quite back and forth. And I know you don't think that it plays a role. And I know there are a lot of studies in knockout mice that show that if you knock out AMP kinase, you still have a normal glucose uptake in the mouse, in the muscles. But there are actually also a few studies that show that it's not completely normal. But it's
what about
quite
humans?
Clear.
What about humans?
Yeah, that's right. So I know you've shown that if you're a well-trained subject, you can still take up a lot of glucose without seeing any activation of AMP kinase. So that's of course also talks or speaks against its role. But Jan Wojciechowski and Rasmus Kribstedt have quite convincingly shown that at least it regulates glucose uptake following exercise, AMP kinase. So I don't know. My view is probably that it in most situations it may play a role during exercise, but it's not essential and it can be substituted quite easily by other mechanisms. But I mean, it's you know, when you in a resting muscle, if you activate AMP kinase pharmacologically, glucose uptake goes up because there's GLUT4 translocation. So it would seem logical, and that's what we've been thinking for many years, that of course it's part of the mechanism. But I guess it's controversial, and I guess most of the findings suggest that it doesn't, it's not necessary at least, but it might contribute.
Well, it's been an interesting time, isn't it? I mean, we've been all trying to work this out for years, and years and years ago, I was talking to you about coming over and infusing nitric oxide synthase inhibitors during exercise and all sorts of things, and we're looking at AMPK, and I assumed AMPK as well. We did studies with, as you say, with ACAR, and it increases glucose uptake by activating AMPK, and if you have a knockout mouse, then you don't get the increase in glucose uptake with ACAR activating, because you can't activate AMPK or whatever. But yeah, it seems we were talking the other day in the corridor, myself, you, Jan Wojciechowski. It's kind of weird, because at one stage we were looking at nitric oxide, and you have an NNOS knockout, and it's got normal glucose uptake during exercise. Then you have CAM kinase, and you have a CAM kinase knockout, has normal glucose uptake during exercise. An AMPK knockout is normal. So as you say, sounds like it may be redundancy, and the stuff that you mentioned, Carlos, so he was on podcast a few weeks ago, so that's really interesting stuff with the reactive oxygen species. Now, you mentioned the phosphoproteome, so just making sure people are clear on that. So basically, if you add a phosphate to, an amino acid in a protein, it can affect its activity and things. And as you were saying yourself with David James, finding 1,000, so you do 10 minutes of exercise, you're getting 1,000 different enzymes basically getting phosphorylated, and some of them are getting phosphorylated at more than just one site. And the phosphorylation, is normally activating, but sometimes it's exactly some are some are activated, some are dephosphorylated, so actually reducing the phosphorylation. So it gets very complicated, doesn't it? And we were just talking earlier, why don't you just also mention the other sort of, these are called post-translational modifications. So you've already made the protein, and then it gets post-translationally modified by adding a phosphate, removing a phosphate. Why don't you just touch on just how complex things are getting? What else do we know about exercise affecting other sort of ohms?
Oh, the ohms. Well, there are a lot of ohms, and I mean, there is also, of course, you also affect gene transcription. You have various genes when you exercise, and that's been well described. But there are also, we are actually also have a paper where we look at ubiquitination of proteins during exercise. And when you attach the molecule ubiquitin to another protein, then that is usually a death sign. So that leads to degradation of the protein where the ubiquitin has been attached to. And we found with David and Ben Parker that in muscle with exercise, you actually increase the ubiquitination of many proteins. And I think that is part of the health benefits of exercise, because it cleans up the muscles. So when you increase ubiquitination, you get rid of a lot of proteins that are probably not ready to be degraded. So it's a cleaning up process that you actually accelerate with exercise, and that is, I think, also very important. There are other ohms, sumulation, where you attach another molecule, sumo molecule, and that leads to changes in the localization of the protein and its properties and so on. We don't know so much about sumulation in skeletal muscle, but in other organs, it regulates a lot of protein functions and so on. So there are many. There's methylation as well, and other ohms that we can probably see in the literature coming up more and more in the exercise literature.
Yeah. Well, I know you mentioned the ROS and I mentioned nitric oxide. There's S-nitrosylation when you're adding like a nitric oxide. Yeah. Sort of. There's S-glutathionation. There's all these things going on. So I guess what I'm wondering about is, you know, does it sort of get too complicated? Because I remember about 20 years ago or something, when everyone started looking at gene arrays, looking at the changes in messenger RNA in the muscle, people were like, oh, that's the end of physiology now. We don't have to worry about physiology. It's all genes. And then we found that obviously wasn't the case. But now it's like you got your phosphoproteome, your S-glutathionome, your sumulationome, whatever it is. Do you think there's still a place for, you know, is this the end of sort of normal integrative physiology, or do you think we still need to sort of work out what's going on by doing sort of integrative physiology experiments?
Well, obviously that's what I think, being an integrated physiologist myself. I mean, molecular biology is great and you get a lot of insight into mechanisms, but you also still want to see how is the body working in real life during exercise and so on. So we are not going to get rid of integrative physiology, exercise physiology. I hope not, at least. But it's the more you can do with molecular biology, the more you get into the mechanisms of what's going on. But if you can still perform the molecular biology in tissues or blood that come from humans during exercise, following exercise, different diets or whatever, or that we do here, then I think you're still doing pretty valuable research, because the human angle is still, I mean, the most important angle. And
exactly,
if you can
right.
Combine these two, then I think we are doing well.
Well, that's the thing I want to make sure people are clear on. So you mentioned, you know, mouse and perfused rat hind limbs and knockout mice and things, but just how much you do in humans. So why don't you tell, because when I first came over, I was doing studies with femoral artery and femoral vein catheters and muscle biopsies in one leg. Why don't you tell them, you know, the sort of things you can do and the stuff we've been doing together. So for example, the first study we did with the NOS inhibitor, why don't you just tell them all the different bits and pieces we did? And it's just amazing. Like, Eric isn't just sort of like setting it up and he just leaves for the rest of the day and then says what's happening with the data. He's setting it up and he's there the whole day. So why don't you just give a bit of an idea to people of the sort of things we can measure, the contrast and edge ultrasound and all sorts of things.
Well, sure. So I've, in my research, I've benefited a lot from being a medical doctor, because that allows me to do invasive studies. So what we've done with you, for instance, is, and we've done in many other studies, is to catheterize the legs, both legs, for instance. So you catheterize the femoral artery and the femoral vein, so you can collect blood from the blood that's going into the leg and the blood that's leaving the leg, and you can then measure AV differences. If you can also measure blood flow, you can, for instance, and you can get a quantitative measure of glucose uptake, lactate release, or whatever else you can measure an AV difference from. Then we also take muscle biopsies usually from the vastus lateralis, and that of course is valuable to look at molecular mechanisms in the muscle. We've also done microdialysis with the idea to measure interstitial glucose concentration. And that, of course, has in the study we did together, where we manipulated blood flow with the nitric oxide synthase inhibitors, we could see that the interstitial glucose concentration is varying quite a lot with the flow. And in that particular study, we also did a euglycemic hyperinsulinemic clamp, so that we could raise the insulin concentration but keep the blood glucose constant by infusing insulin. So we had this whole package of individuals that had been exercising with actually one leg only. That's what we often do, because then we can look at the other leg as a non-exercise control leg. And so when you then look at post-exercise insulin sensitivity, you can then look at the two legs and combine the glucose uptake that is going on when you increase the insulin concentration. And we found, as you know, that the interstitial glucose concentration during a clamp actually decreases quite a lot, and decreases more in the exercise leg than the rested leg. And that gave us the idea that perhaps you could say this might be you could use the word an artifact of the clamp, because you are increasing the plasma insulin concentration without increasing the plasma glucose concentration. And that is an artificial situation, right? Normally when you eat, you increase your insulin concentration because the glucose concentration goes up, because you digest the food and you release glucose into the bloodstream, and then you activate insulin secretion. That doesn't happen during a clamp. So we discussed, you and I, whether it would be interesting to do a meal instead of a clamp following exercise. And that is not yet published, but I guess it will be published pretty soon.
Well, I'm writing it at the moment, as you know. When's that draft going to be ready? Yeah. Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff there to unpack, but I want to make sure people are clear, because it was all very well talking about doing that first study, but when I actually saw the person with all the catheters and the things, although, as you know, I did do it myself as well. So I like to do to people what I've had done myself. So Eric stuck catheters in both my femoral artery and femoral veins, and we looked at glucose uptake and infused nitric oxide synthase inhibitors into both the rested leg and the exercise leg. So that was pretty amazing. But yeah, you're literally doing, and what you didn't mention as well is we did contrast enhanced ultrasound.
Oh,
so why don't
right,
you just say a little bit about that as well?
Okay, you know, well, that is a technique where you can visualize the capillary perfusion, and it was a technique developed in the US, I guess. It's been used in cardiac in the clinic for cardiac monitoring, but Eugene Barrett worked with it in muscle, and Michael Clark in Hobart, and developed it for use in muscle. And Steve Radigan was also quite involved in those studies. So we actually adopted the technique where you actually infuse just intravenously micro bubbles that are the size of a red blood cell, so it can enter the capillaries. So these bubbles can enter the capillaries, and then you can image them with ultrasound. And then what happens is that you give a blast of high energy ultrasound, so you destroy all the bubbles in the little region of interest that you're looking at, in the thigh, for instance. Could be other places, but we did it in the thigh. And then you can image the refilling of the vascular compartments with the micro bubbles following the high energy blast, and that gives you an index of capillary perfusion. And and we were able to show that in the exercised leg, the leg that had exercised 4 hours before we did the clamp, the effect of insulin was actually quite a lot larger, so that the increase in capillary perfusion was significantly higher in the leg that had exercised compared to the leg that hadn't exercised. So there's also a very important vascular component of the increased insulin sensitivity following exercise. So you increase the delivery of glucose, and you also of course have the increased GLUT4 translocation in the muscle that has exercised. But in the clamp, as we just talked about, it the delivery is apparently not enough to keep the interstitial glucose concentration up, so it falls. But if you do a meal where you get hyperglycemia as well as hyperinsulinemia, we found that the interstitial glucose actually goes up, which is what you would expect. But it also leads to a much higher glucose uptake, particularly in the exercised leg, where there's a large capacity for glucose transport into the muscle and also glucose disposition to right. take care of the glucose that is coming into the muscle.
All right. So there's a lot of stuff there. And obviously, you and me have been sort of living and breathing all this stuff. So I might just make sure people are clear and just the really cool stuff as well. So as I said, the first subject we did, it's seven catheters in here. Yeah. So femoral artery and femoral vein of both legs. And then we had a catheter to infuse the microbubbles for the contrast and ultrasound, as you said, for muscle blood flow. So you're not just getting leg, but you're getting the muscle blood flow. And then we had the catheter for infusing glucose and insulin. And then, believe it or not, you'd think, you know, because you've got femoral artery and femoral vein in there, you could measure arterial blood, but we couldn't because we were infusing a nitric oxide synthase inhibitor at times into the femoral artery to block the flow. So we had to have a catheter in the hand and heat the hand to get arterialized glucose samples. And anyway, it was quite funny because when you were first putting the catheters in, I was like, to me, it felt pretty heavy having that many catheters going in. And I was like, Eric does all this all the time. And then you actually said, well, you don't normally, because you normally do one femoral artery and then both femoral veins, because you can, you know, assume obviously the artery is the same concentration in both, which is obviously correct. But because we were infusing NOS inhibitor, you couldn't get a sample from the femoral artery. Yeah. Okay, so that was that. And then we had the biopsies, yeah? So three biopsies from each leg, rested leg, exercise leg. Anyway, so just make sure people are clear. So basically what we find, you do the one leg exercise, you wait 3 or 4 hours for the glucose uptake and the blood flow to go back to normal. So it's the same in both legs. You do the clamp, as you said, infuse glucose and insulin. You find the glucose uptake's higher in the previously exercised leg. Also, the insulin signaling is higher in the previously exercised leg. But then the really novel thing, I guess, is when we gave the NOS inhibitor and prevented the blood flow effect, because it's a vasoconstrictor, you could prevent the insulin sensitizing effect. Yeah, so it kind of showed you need the insulin signaling and you need the flow. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, it's fair enough.
All right, so just making sure people are on the same page, and then we can get to the meal. So because you were saying a lot of stuff there that so as we showed, though, that the glucose levels in the interstitium dropped because the muscle's like sucking up so much, especially the exercise leg, that the glucose levels actually drop in the interstitium, which is what's sort of bathing the fibers, yeah? And then maybe, if you don't mind, just say again that the idea with the meal, because I just think we might have lost a few people there, and then we can talk a bit more about that.
Well, I mean, so in the meal, you, of course, if you give we gave a fairly carbohydrate-rich meal, but not only carbohydrate, it was a normal meal, but with, I guess, 55 or 60% carbohydrates or so. Then it was a pretty large meal, and you get a large increase in glucose, plasma glucose, from 5.5 millimolar, which is what you have in the fasting state, up to around 9, 9.5 millimolar at the peak. So that's a fairly large increase in glucose. And that actually then stimulates the pancreas to secrete endogenous insulin. So we actually reached concentrations of insulin that were around 100 microunits per ml, which is what we normally use when we camp people. So it was about the same. So I was kind of fortunate. And that was, of course, our goal, but we were happy to see that we actually reached the goal. So with this, and also in this situation, the blood flow increased with the meal, as you might expect, because insulin is a vasodilator, and it increased more in the exercise leg compared to the rested leg. So you have this large delivery of glucose because the glucose concentration is very high. You have an increased blood flow, not a lot, but a bit. And then you have the high insulin, and that creates ideal conditions for taking up glucose into the muscle. And it looked like, and so the difference, we found the difference between the leg that had exercised beforehand compared to the rested leg was actually quite a lot larger than what we've seen previously with the clamp, where we have euglycemia, normal glucose concentration. And that was mainly because the exercise leg was able to take up a lot more glucose when we had hyperglycemia and hyperinsulinemia than during the clamp, where you have low or at least normal plasma glucose. Whereas in the rested leg, the glucose uptake was not really increased that much compared to what we would expect with such a high glucose concentration. So it actually looked like, and also in the muscle biopsies, that there was a problem in the rested leg handling all the glucose. So it was sort of being, it was not being able to be disposed into the glycogen pool in the rested leg, whereas in the exercise leg, you could get rid of all the glucose coming in. So you didn't have any accumulation of glucose, which we saw in the rested leg. So the rested leg was not really able to handle all the delivered glucose very well. So it sort of got stuck as glucose in the muscle and was not further metabolized to the same extent as in the exercise leg.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, isn't it? So as you said, so when you do a clamp, you see the glucose uptake keeps going over the next 2 or 3 hours, whatever you do the clamp for, in both the legs. But we found with the meal, the exercise and the rested leg went up about the same for the first 15 minutes. And then the rested leg just stopped. Oh, sorry, it just stayed the same. And the exercise leg kept going up, and it was like about double, which is more than what you get in a clamp. So as you say, it looked like there was actually some sort of inhibition. Well, it's not like it's inhibition makes you think it's been reduced, but it just sort of stayed the same, yeah? Because as you said, the free glucose in the muscle went up and the glucose 6-phosphate went up. So glucose gets phosphorylated, as we said earlier, to glucose 6-phosphate. And that wasn't sort of getting shuttled off. It was just sort of accumulating a bit, so maybe inhibiting further glucose uptake. So again, very different to the clamp. So what do we say, therefore? You mentioned the word artifact, and we've sort of bandied that around a bit when we've been chatting about it. What do you make of this? So as you know, we've talked about, I'm going to be writing a perspective on you know, meals versus clamps, and what do we take away, and what do we have to consider with the clamp, and do people need to think more about this and that? So what do you, can you sort of just elaborate on that a little bit?
I mean, So the great thing about the clamp, of course, is that you have steady state conditions. You have constant glucose, you have constant insulin, and that is really nice if you want to make measurements of insulin sensitivity, steady state. In a meal, you don't have steady state. You have constantly changing plasma glucose going up and going down. You have insulin going up and going down. So that is more difficult to, you don't have steady state, and therefore it's a much more dynamic system, and you have to interpret the findings differently from the clamp, because you don't have steady state, which is really necessary if you want to get a good measure of insulin sensitivity. But on the other hand, in real life, you don't have a clamp, you have meals, and you ingest carbohydrates or whatever you ingest. So the meal study is more a model of what happens during everyday life, and it can still be used to look at insulin action, but you just have to be aware of that you don't have steady state. So it's not it's not a real measure of insulin sensitivity as such as what you can get with a clamp. So you have to consider the differences.
I guess we just have to make sure people are clear. So instead of doing a clamp, we were just doing a meal. So we still had the same, you know, femoral artery, femoral vein, but they just had a meal. I guess people at home or whatever can't sort of go off and do that. So the other thing, I guess, is, you know, we've talked about continuous glucose monitoring, and we even had that at the start of the study. We were mucking around with that because, you know, continuous glucose monitoring measures interstitial glucose, but it's just, you know, in the fat. And we were measuring interstitial glucose, you know, 3 inches down in the muscle, and they aren't necessarily the same. Do you think it's something, you know, that people could think about doing here and there if they were interested, especially, I know, people with diabetes? But, you know, some people were all over the place saying, oh, you know, everyone should be doing their continuous glucose monitoring. They shouldn't be getting these glucose spikes. Try and stop glucose spikes as much as you can. You have any thoughts on any of that stuff? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it depends a lot who you are. Obviously, if you're a type 1 diabetic, it's very useful to use continuous glucose monitoring. That's for sure. For people that do not have diabetes, I mean, if you want to measure, follow your glucose and you are maybe insulin resistant, overweight, and so on, maybe it's a good idea to try to prevent too many spikes in plasma glucose so you can use it for that. But if you are a normal young person who is physically active, not overweight, I don't see the big need for it. But of course, it gives you information on your body. So if you're one of those people that really like to know what's going on in your body during everyday life, and if you're exercising, you want to know, am I getting hypoglycemic or what's going on? And then fine. I've used it myself a few times just to see. Just to see what's going on. And I mean, it's fun to see. And every time it you eat, you see a little spike and then it goes down. And you can see that during the night, you actually get quite low levels, actually down to around 3 millimolar, even though you're not taking any medicine or anything like that. So yeah, I think it's
really
fun.
Remember last time I was here in 2019, I had this idea in my head to see what happened if I fasted for 5 days and I was still exercising every day. And one day I got home for the back to the lab and I almost collapsed. And it's like, okay, it's time to stop this. Now, there's a question on Twitter that feeds in with this. Mark asked, to what extent are the exercise-induced increases in glucose disposal attributed to an increased incretin effect and or glucose effectiveness? So that feeds in with what we've been doing with the meal. So maybe, you know, the clamp, you're not really getting that. Maybe explain what incretins are. That's okay first, and then
Okay. So incretins are gut hormones that are released upon eating something, and the most known ones are GLP-1 and GIP, and We actually measured them also in the meal study that we've been talking about, and sure enough, they go up quite a lot. And does it play a role for glucose uptake? We don't know, but actually, at least GLP-1, we've showed that in a study 10 years ago, that if you infuse GLP-1 into a leg, you see that it actually increases blood flow. So it has some vascular properties that are probably participating in the effect of insulin on the vasculature during a meal. So in that respect, they might play a role, but they don't. In that study that we did where we infused GLP-1, we did not see any increase in glucose uptake per se. So GLP-1 is not able to increase glucose uptake as such directly on the muscle, but it actually is a vasodilator, so it increases blood flow. Not a lot, but it is similar to what insulin can do. So if you have the vascular, if the vasodilated effect of insulin, and on top of that, the vasodilation of GLP-1, then maybe that will increase or get more vasodilation, and then hence also increased delivery of glucose following a meal. So in that respect, it might play a role, but it doesn't have a direct effect on muscle glucose uptake.
All right. So just thinking about, we've talked about acute exercise, but exercise training. So we know exercise training increases insulin sensitivity of muscle. And again, there's been some studies with people with type 2 diabetes, but probably not that many. Just wondering if you could talk a bit about the effect of the acute bout versus the chronic effects. You know, is the effect of training just the last bout of exercise, or is there like an additive training effect?
Well, it's a good question, and you can say that if you train regularly, you will often be in the post-exercise phase, right? So you will still have the acute effects of the last exercise bout. But in addition to that, when you're exercise training, you will create changes in the muscle that also lead to increased insulin sensitivity. And those are, for instance, increased GLUT4 protein expression. So when you have a trained muscle, you get more GLUT4, so you can move more glucose transporters to the surface membrane. You also get more hexokinase, which is the enzyme that phosphorylates glucose when it comes into the muscle. And that, of course, helps disposing of the glucose so it doesn't accumulate as free glucose. So that is also an important finding. In the trained muscle, you also get an increased capillarization with the training, so that you probably have better supply of glucose and maybe also insulin in the trained muscle. So you get a lot of chronic changes in the muscle that are conducive to increased insulin sensitivity. Mm-hmm. And those will last for longer time, maybe weeks or maybe even, weeks, probably a few weeks. So when you are exercise training and you look at insulin sensitivity, you have to think about, well, am I both well trained and in the post exercise phase, or am I further away from the last training bout? So it's only the effect of training that I'm seeing. So those are two different things, because the acute bouts of exercise do not change the gene expression. They change the gene expression, but it's not something that is strong enough to change the protein content of the muscle. So that for that, you need several bouts of exercise so that you get changes in the protein content of the muscle. For instance, GLUT4, hexokinase.
Good for it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. And I've got a question here from Mark again. I think I mentioned Mark. Are there differences in the chronic increased muscle insulin sensitivity between performing regular resistance training or aerobic type training? So I guess we tend to, you know, the one-legged kicking things we do, et cetera, is like an hour. It's more endurance exercise. Resistance training. And it makes me think about that paper we were both on with Jan Modicheski, who's been on the podcast as well. I used to always say, well, as long as you're breaking down glycogen, you're going to get an increase in insulin sensitivity. But we kind of know that it's maybe not that simple, right?
So Jan made the effort to actually look at all the clamps that we've been doing over the last 20 years here in this department, and he collected 13 studies and looked at whether there was a correlation. 13 studies that had fairly similar protocol, one leg exercise and then a clamp afterwards, and then you could correlate the increase in insulin sensitivity following exercise with the breakdown of glycogen during exercise, because we also took muscle biopsies to measure glycogen. And in those 13 studies, when you put all those data together in a meta analysis, there was surprisingly no correlation between the increased insulin sensitivity and the glycogen breakdown or the glycogen content per se. We actually expected that there would be, like you, that there would be a correlation, but that wasn't the case. And another interesting thing about this meta-analysis that was published fairly recently in Diabetes, the journal Diabetes, was that there, as we know, there's a huge variability between individual insulin sensitivity, even in a group of people. So we've usually studied fairly young males that are recreationally active, so they're not obese, they're not athletes, but just regular students mostly that use a bicycle for local transportation around Copenhagen and so on. And even though they're fairly similar in body composition and VO2 max and so on, there's a huge individual variation in the insulin sensitivity that we can measure with the clamp. So that's quite interesting to try to figure out why is there this big change or this big difference in insulin sensitivity in these individuals. And in that paper, we were also able to show that the increase in insulin sensitivity that you get with exercise, similar bouts of exercise in all these 13 studies, was also quite variable. So some people gain a lot of insulin sensitivity when they exercise, some gain very little. What the reason for that is not really that well known at the moment. But of course, interesting to figure out, so that you can sort of get personalized physiology, personalized, maybe the foundation for personalized medicine, which is very popular these days, to figure out what are the individual differences that actually are important for your insulin sensitivity. What is it in the muscle that is so important for us? That some have very high insulin sensitivity, some have very low insulin sensitivity. So that's an ongoing research question, and particularly Jørn is following that route.
It is really surprising, isn't it? Because just like we were talking about with AMPK, you know, you get ACAR, which activates AMPK, increases glucose uptake. So therefore you'd think it would be, you know, playing a role in exercise. Well, the same thing with exercise increases glycogen synthase activity. So it's wanting to take up glucose and synthesize glycogen. But it's not necessarily increasing glycogen. Well, I guess, did he actually look? He probably hasn't looked at that, whether, you know, the people that have the low glucose uptake also have lower activation of glycogen synthase or whatever. I guess they haven't done that.
But that's not the case. That's not the case.
And I guess it also makes sense in a way, because endurance athletes have elevated muscle glycogen, but they also have higher insulin sensitivity. So I guess it means there's more going on. So resistance. So if people are just wondering, what's best for my increase in insulin sensitivity? Should I do endurance or weight training? I mean, what do you think they both do?
Well, right? I mean, both forms of exercise increase your insulin sensitivity. And I guess probably I don't think it's been really compared very accurately, but we know that both resistance exercise and endurance exercise increases insulin sensitivity. I would assume that endurance does it more because you get more capillarization and you don't get big fibers, which might not be the best for insulin sensitivity, but resistance exercise actually also increases insulin sensitivity. So you can choose what you want, you can choose what you feel is best for you what you actually do. So if people ask what kind of exercise should I do, the answer is do any exercise and the one that you like the most.
Exactly right.
That is what I would say, at least.
I guess the other thing with chronic, so you know, training with resistance training, is you get the increase in lean mass. So you have more muscle as well, I guess. So it's a different sort of different kettle of fish. Talking about exercising, what about you? Do you do much exercise? I know you do. I know the answer, but I'm just asking.
Well, yeah, as you sure know, I bike to work every day. So that's 7 kilometers in and 7 kilometers out. Then I run a bit in the week on the weekends, or bike. And I'm pretty proud of actually that I'm able to run 5Ks in 25 minutes, which is, I think, pretty decent in considering the age that I have reached now.
And we're not allowed to ask what age you've reached. It's rude, so I won't ask that. I've got another question here from Martin on Twitter. Is there a relationship between HIT, hyperglycemia, and appetite regulation? So I guess we were talking earlier about if you do high-intensity exercise, you can get an increase in glucose, which is called hyperglycemia. So is there a relationship between HIT, hyperglycemia, and appetite regulation?
Well, interesting question. Well, what can I say? I mean, it's pretty well known that if you do high intensity exercise, then afterwards you are not hungry, at least for a while. So there is some exercise induced diminishing of your appetite, and then you of course get the appetite later. But it can take quite a while, and it depends on how high intensity you do and how long you do it, of course. Yeah, so that's pretty well described, and we don't really know the mechanism, but probably it's not so much the glucose, because if you just elevate the glucose in a clamp by infusing more glucose than you actually dispose of, then it doesn't seem to affect appetite very much. But there could be other mechanisms. For instance, we collaborated with Jonathan Long at Stanford. And he's interested in this substance called LACFI, and published a nice paper in Nature about LACFI. And LACFI is actually, so when you exercise at high intensity, you make a lot of lactate. That's well known, and lactate can be fused to phenylalanine, hence the name LACFI. So it's a fusion product. And there's an enzyme that does that. And if you synthesize LACFI in the lab and then inject it into a mouse, then you'll see that the mouse will eat less than it does if you don't inject it, or you inject just a vehicle. So it looks like LACFI has some appetite regulating effects. Mm. And we've also shown, we collaborated with him, and in some of our studies where we actually did 3 Wingate tests in our subjects where really high intensity exercise repeated, we reached lactate levels around 15 millimolars. And in those experiments, we also saw, so we sent the blood to Jonathan Long, and he could measure that LACFI was really increased quite remarkably. So, of course, if you do high intensity exercise, you produce a lot of lactate, you get LACFI, and that will probably affect your appetite. We don't know in humans because we haven't done infusion studies and stuff, but at least if you extrapolate from the mouse, that could be one of the reasons that you feel less hungry after high intensity exercise. There are other hormones that might play a role.
There's a lot of interest in lactate nowadays. Obviously, George Brooks has been interested in lactate for a long time, and I've been trying to get him on the podcast, actually, and he hasn't come on yet. But lactate seems to be doing all sorts of things. So I think it's fair to say lactate isn't just as baddie. You know, people probably think if they could take a pill and get rid of lactate, they'd be happier. But
I don't think so. So, I mean, there are other things like the GDF-15, growth and differentiation factor 15, that we've worked with for quite a while now. And that also increases the plasma concentration of GDF-15 increases during exercise in humans as well as in mice. And if you inject GDF-15 into an obese mouse, you will also see that it affects the appetite. So the mouse will eat less and it will lose weight. So that could also be a way that exercise actually diminishes your appetite, especially if you do high intensity exercise.
Wow. Okay. So the another one that what the person that asked Martin the question about HIT, hyperglycemia, and appetite, along these lines, and you were just talking about losing weight, how is energy status impacting glucose metabolism and insulin? So he talks about REDS, so relative energy deficiency in sport. So I guess, and we touched on this a bit before we came on air, do you want to just talk a little bit about, fasting or eating insufficiently and what effect that has on metabolism?
Well, obviously, if you intake less calories than you expend, then you will lose weight. And of course, the most dramatic way to lose weight is to fast, and if you don't eat anything. And we know that maybe contrary to what you might expect, then fasting actually leads to insulin resistance, quite dramatic insulin resistance. So you could see that's probably a good way of getting insulin resistant, because it's physiological and it protects your carbohydrate stores from being used too much. And it's a maybe a different way of getting insulin resistant compared to people that are overweight or obese, and some of them have type 2 diabetes. I don't know. I mean, they're also insulin resistant. Whether that's a protective mechanism can also be thought of, because you sort of protect the organism from storing even more glucose in tissues that are maybe not suited to store glucose. Like you get a lot of adipose tissue growth, of course, if you are eating more than you spend. So that's maybe a different form of insulin resistance. But of course, if you just cut your energy status or your energy intake to not being fasting, but just decreasing it, I don't really know what happens to insulin sensitivity. I guess it depends on how much you cut. And we know, of course, from females that many females, they are having problems with energy deficiency and affecting their menstrual cycle and all that. So whether that's the same in males, you could speculate that your production of male hormones might be affected by decreasing your energy intake. I don't know. We actually did a study. It was actually Bente Keynes who was the pioneer, where we many years ago, where she had individuals that substituted their protein source from animal sources to vegetables protein. So the same amount of protein in the diet, but either animal protein or vegetable protein. And the guys, these were young men, and they had this diet for 5 weeks, I think. And one of the findings that were a little bit surprising were that if you substitute your proteins from animals proteins to vegetables, you actually lower your testosterone concentration. And that might not be very good if you are an athlete, a male athlete. So that's just a
That's
consideration.
interesting.
But just what it does to metabolism to cut your energy intake. I mean, obviously you lose weight and you increase your lipolysis and so on because you're energy deficient. It would probably lead to decreased insulin action, I would assume, just like fasting does.
It's interesting that because you mentioned how fasting can make you insulin resistant, it may be to maintain your carbohydrate levels. Because people often assume that when you're fasting, you're losing this weight at the start because your glycogen is getting broken down and there's, 2 or 3 grams of water being stored with every gram of glycogen. But when you fast, unless you're exercising, your glycogen doesn't really change for the first 2 or 3, 4 days.
Not in the muscle, but in the liver it does.
Oh, sorry, of course. Sorry, I'm a bit muscle centric. Yes, in the liver, absolutely.
But you're right. I mean, and if you're overweight or obese and you cut your energy intake, then you lose weight, and that has clearly been shown in a lot of studies that that increases your insulin sensitivity.
Yep.
But that's when you're coming from an overweight state to a less overweight state. So if you're a normal weight and you cut your energy intake, yeah, I don't know exactly if that would increase or decrease your insulin sensitivity. It probably
Okay.
depends on how much you cut. If you're cutting a lot, so you are getting close to fasting, then you'll probably get resistance.
Guess it would make a difference if you're exercising or not as well. So if you're losing the weight through exercise, I'm assuming that would increase because exercise increases your insulin sensitivity.
Absolutely.
And And I guess that's what we're designed to do, right? We're meant to be actually physically active, hunter and gathering. The state that we're in nowadays is not normal. And there's sometimes people talk, you know, Frank Booth, for example, talks about if you have a rat on a running wheel, you know, rather than that being like the exercise train rat, that should be your normal rat. And then the one that hasn't got the running wheel is the sedentary one. Right. So,
yeah. Well, the increased insulin sensitivity and muscle after exercise makes perfectly sense physiologically, because then that allows you to direct the glucose into the muscles that have been active and that have broken down their glycogen. So even though glycogen in itself doesn't seem to affect insulin sensitivity, then it is important to be able to resynthesize your glycogen stores following exercise, absolutely. So you're ready for the next exercise bout. Yeah.
All right, great. Now, one you actually mentioned the other day would be a good one to talk about was the very interesting question of how glucose escapes metabolism in gut cells, and for instance, kidney, where it is absorbed/reabsorbed. What's that about?
Well, that's because I've been involved in writing a review with some people that I'm knowledgeable about how glucose is actually handled in other tissues in the body. And one of the really intriguing questions is that when you eat carbohydrates and you absorb glucose into the intestinal cell, and then of course the glucose comes out on the basolateral membrane and goes into the bloodstream. That's, of course, well known. That's why we see an increase in glucose. But when you think about it, then the epithelial cell in the gut takes up glucose and then somehow has to transport it through the cell and have it leaving the cell without being metabolized. Because in the muscle, we know that when glucose comes in, it is phosphorylated immediately, and then it's further metabolized, either stored as glycogen or oxidized. But that is not what you want in a epithelial cell in the gut, because you want it to traverse the cell without being phosphorylated or metabolized. It could be phosphorylated, but you don't want it further metabolized. So that is really an interesting question. How does the cell actually avoid the metabolism of the glucose that comes in? Because the gut cell does have hexokinase, so it can phosphorylate the glucose. So what is thought is that maybe it's phosphorylated, and then there's a glucose 6-phosphatase that is also a transporter that transports it into the endoplasmatic reticulum, reticulum in the cell, and then it is chaperoned towards the basolateral membrane of the gut cell, and it then somehow escapes through the basolateral route, and that has been thought to be GLUT2, glucose transporter 2, that does that job. But there are actually knockout studies where people have knocked out GLUT2, and still the transport mechanism seems to work pretty well. So it's some of it probably leaves through GLUT2, but some of it may leave via some process that we don't really understand that well from the endoplasmatic reticulum, maybe some vesicles or something that fuse with the basolateral membrane and somehow lets the glucose escape. Because it's probably not going between, it's not going between the cells, it's going through the actual cells. The same conundrum is actually in the kidney, where you reabsorb glucose from the blood and somehow, or from the urine, and then you want it to be reabsorbed into the blood. So there's a lot of good questions there that to some extent are known, but I think there's still some knowledge gaps in how glucose actually evades metabolism in those cells that actually can transport it through the cell. Quite interesting.
That's interesting. It makes me think of, it's different, but it makes me think of, you know, when you have a meal and you, glucose is absorbed and then you assume it to be taken up by the liver, but the liver doesn't really take up glucose. I know it's different because you're talking about going through cells, but it goes sort of straight through the liver. A lot of it doesn't get taken up in the first pass. And it's called like the indirect pathway. It just makes me think of that anyway. You know what I mean? Like when you have a meal, you assume that it's going, the glucose going through the portal vein would be taken up by the liver, but a lot of it tends to go straight through and then gives the periphery a shot at it.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. And the funny thing is, or the interesting thing is, that after exercise, it looks like a larger part of the glucose that is absorbed when you eat is actually escaping liver metabolism. So that some mechanism exists so that you bypass the liver, and that is probably because you need it to replenish your glycogen stores in the muscles. Maybe exactly. Before the liver. Yeah.
And it's great you mentioned that, because that's a misunderstanding some people have. So I think was it Rose? It was Mark Hargraves, maybe Kirsten Heller. You know, people sometimes, you do like an oral glucose tolerance test. So you drink 75 grams of glucose after exercise, you actually get a greater increase in glucose than you get at rest. And people go, oh, that means you're glucose intolerant. Mm. But as you say, you actually want that, right? You want the glucose to get through to give the muscle the first shot at it.
Mm.
Yeah, that's right. Cool. All right. And also, just talking about the glucose transport, it reminded me of, you know, what we've been talking about with this, with a meal and with a clamp, the fact that the glucose has to get from the blood into the interstitium. And I know you've done some work on this, that, you know, is it going through cells or is it going through slits? Did we not just talk about that briefly in the knockout study you did, et cetera?
Yeah, so in the muscle, So when you have glucose in the blood, in the capillaries, obviously to get into the muscle, you have to leave the capillary and get into the interstitial space and then into the muscle. So the question has been, how does glucose in the muscle leave the capillaries? It's quite different in the brain compared to the muscle, but that's another story. But in the muscle, it was shown in the 50s already that small molecules like glucose, urea, fructose can exit muscle capillaries through some slits or pores, or at least some sort of openings between the endothelial cells. So it's like a sieve. So it lets small molecules just run through the holes in the capillaries, and that's of course very nice and very efficient, but there were some quite interesting studies performed in the 70s actually by Christian Krohne, where they actually injected labeled D glucose and and L glucose, which is the isomer of glucose. Of the normal glucose. So normal glucose is D glucose. And then they injected it into the cat muscle as a perfused cat muscle and looked at the outflow curves for both D and L glucose. And if glucose only leaves by the slits, then there would be no difference in the exit in the outflow curves of D and L glucose, because they're the same size and they can go through the same holes, and that would be it. But there was actually a small difference. It was not very large, but there was a little difference, so that D glucose actually left the capillaries a little bit better than L glucose.
Okay.
And if that's only due to a hole in the membrane or to slits between the cells, then that wouldn't happen. So somehow there seems to be a slight preference, and we know that the endothelial cells in muscle and in all other organs actually express another glucose transporter called GLUT1. And the idea was then, well, maybe this GLUT1 is making the difference, so that the difference between D and L glucose could be that GLUT1 is transporting some of the glucose into the capillary cell and then releasing it on the other side into the interstitial via these glucose transporters. not a very important effect, but it could be explaining why there was a small difference between D and L glucose. So we, together with Katrin de Bock in Zurich, we did a study in endothelial specific inducible GLUT1 knockout mice. So you knock out GLUT1 specifically in the endothelial cells in the mouse. And then we looked at the interstitial glucose concentration with microdialysis in the mouse, and it was quite a difficult task. And Kim Schubert was really instrumental in making this work. So we actually were able to do microdialysis in a little mouse muscle while it was sedated, and then we did a clamp to increase the glucose transport from the blood to the muscle, increase the glucose uptake in the muscle. And if GLUT1 was important, we would assume that the interstitial space would decrease more in the GLUT1 knockout mice than in the control mice, but that was not the case.
Okay.
So that says that glucose, in for all practical purposes, leaves the skeletal muscle capillaries via the slits that are between the cells, and it's not a glucose transporter phenomenon. Even though, I mean, so you can then ask, why do the glucose or the why do the endothelial cells have glucose transporters? That's because they are very glycolytic and they use the glucose for their own metabolism, but they don't transport it.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So, you know, we've talked about the interstitial glucose drops in the muscle, especially after exercise when you do a clamp, but not after a meal. So it seems like when your glucose is 5 millimole, that's not enough, and it doesn't just flow through these slits and maintain 5. It's actually not enough, that transport. But when you have a meal and it goes up to, I think we got 9.4 is the highest, and but anyway, it's elevated, that's enough to maintain or even increase.
Yeah.
Interstitial glucose. So it's a little bit fine balance there. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Eric. We've taken a lot of your valuable time. And what I'd like to do is finish up with some sort of takeaway messages from our chat today. One, two, three, four takeaway messages from today I'd like people to get.
Oh, well, what can I say? Exercise increases glucose uptake in a muscle with mechanisms that are independent of insulin.
Mm-hmm.
So exercise works without insulin to increase muscle glucose uptake. The muscle becomes more insulin sensitive after exercise. It lasts for hours, maybe even a day or even maybe 2 days. So that insulin works better in a muscle that has exercised. And that is, of course, good because that funnels glucose into the muscle that has been exercising. But it's also clinically relevant because you can increase insulin sensitivity in conditions with decreased insulin action, so in insulin-resistant patients with diabetes or obesity and so on. Well, what more?
that's probably the main thing. All right. Well, I'd like to thank you again for coming on, and I'd like to thank you for your collaboration and friendship and all that. Having me over 4 times, you're probably slightly over it. Although you did say the other day, maybe you could come back and do another study.
Yeah, that's right. No, you're always welcome, man.
All right. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
See
thank
you, mate.
You.
Bye-bye.
See you.
Bye. Okay. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.